This is Free Speech Radio News for Thursday, February 5, 2004. At WBAI in New York, I'm Deepa Fernandez. CIA Director George Tenet defends U.S. intelligence of pre-war Iraq by saying intelligence never indicated that Iraq was an imminent threat. Grocery workers in California offer to go back to work, but the supermarkets refuse to enter into binding arbitration.
We refuse to go on the system, and I'm not going to go on the system, and I need my contract, I need my health care, I need decent wages. We live day by day now.
And what is behind the Pakistani nuclear scientist's confession of sharing nuclear secrets? But first, these news headlines.
I'm Randy Zimmerman with the headlines for Free Speech Radio News. Halliburton, the company formerly run by Vice President Dick Cheney before he became George Bush's running mate, and one subsidiary are facing another investigation. Megan Britton reports from D.C.
The U.S. Justice Department is scrutinizing Halliburton for allegedly doling out $180 million in bribes to win a natural gas contract with Nigeria in the late 1990s. Vice President Dick Cheney was the company's CEO from 1995 to 2000, the same time that the bribes allegedly took place. Officials at the Justice Department have asked Kellogg Brown & Root, the Halliburton subsidiary, to voluntarily hand over records from the contract with Nigerian liquefied natural gas plant. The inquiry was sparked by embezzlement charges in France against Technip, one of four partners in the Nigerian contract with Halliburton. French officials say they may also file embezzlement charges against Vice President Dick Cheney in Paris. Halliburton's subsidiary, KBR, is currently under investigation by the government for overcharging for meals supplied to U.S. troops in Iraq and fuel deliveries to Iraqi civilians. For Free Speech Radio News in Washington, D.C., I'm Megan Britton.
Members of the Indian Parliament have confirmed that Coca-Cola and Pepsi drinks have enough pesticides in them to harm human health. Binu Alex reports from India.
The Delhi-based Center for Science and Environment had found high residues of toxins far above the norms permitted in the developed world. The MPs asked, "You do not find US colas with pesticides, so why force us to drink pesticides?" The companies are also blamed for polluting water, resulting in skin disorders and other ailments, besides depletion of groundwater and reduced crop yields. The companies, however, continue to maintain that the drinks are safe for human consumption. But with this development, they will have to bring in stringent standards for the water used in the colas. From India, Binu Alex, Free Speech Radio News.
An executive at one of Italy's major news agencies is openly charging President Silvio Berlusconi and his executives at some of his major media holdings with censorship. Diletta Varlese reports from Italy.
A week ago, Daniela Tagliafico, the director of Channel One News, TG1, declared to the journalist meeting that what we present of Italy in our news is totally different from reality. She added, "We are told to offer stories about fitness and holidays, showing a country where social conflicts do not exist." After her resignation, another woman, Lucia Annunziata, president of Rai Administration Council, kept announcing that choices concerning administration personnel and journalists are often induced and suggested directly by phone calls from Mr. Berlusconi. Annunziata has been intimated to give her resignation, while she answered back that the Rai autonomy and pluralism of opinion are struggles I won't give up to defend the public service. For Free Speech Radio News, I am Diletta Varlese in Italy.
Members of the Navajo Nation, environmentalists, ranchers, and other community groups are suing the U.S. Bureau of Land Management over access to land given to natural gas mining interests. From KUNM in Albuquerque, Leslie Clark reports.
The group is arguing the BLM's decision to allow nearly 10,000 new oil and gas wells in New Mexico's San Juan Basin will lead to the destruction of the ranching economy, the region's air quality, and thousands of Native American cultural sites, including Chaco Canyon, a national historic site. The coalition says the BLM hasn't demonstrated it can manage the drilling already underway. The group goes on to say it's tried to compromise with the BLM and that this legal challenge is a last resort. The BLM office in Washington says it wants to consult with federal regulators on the impact of increased drilling. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Leslie Clark in Albuquerque.
The New York City Council denounced the USA Patriot Act joining 249 other cities in three states, and passed a resolution opposing the infringement of civil liberties in the name of national security. More from Amabu Adi at WBAI.
Grassroots activists, coalition members, and volunteers won a decisive victory yesterday when the New York City Council passed the Bill of Rights resolution, which was opposed by 13 out of the City Council's 51 members. The Bill of Rights resolution criticizes the Patriot Act of 2001, which was introduced only 6 weeks after the September 11 attacks. Under this act, the government has the authority to monitor anyone's internet use, religious and political activity, and search a person's home without informing them beforehand. Civil liberties activists like Cheryl Wirtz, director of government access for the New York-based group New Immigrant Community Empowerment, or NICE, believe that the passing of the bill in New York City will send an important message.
Civil rights and civil liberties can't be curtailed in our name. We know more deeply than any other part of the country the cost of terrorism, but the curtailing of civil rights and civil liberties is an undercutting of our democratic values and at the same time does nothing to limit terrorism.
For Free Speech Radio News in New York City, I'm Amma Nsiabwadi.
And I'm Randy Zimmerman for Free Speech Radio News.
Today, CIA Director George Tenet defended U.S. intelligence of pre-war Iraq by saying the intelligence never indicated that Iraq was an imminent threat. Speaking at Georgetown University in Washington, D.C., Tenet said analysts differed on several aspects of Iraq's weapon program that he said were available in the intelligence estimates. However, as FSRN's D.C. editor Mitch Jeserich reports, critics say that President Bush and his administration made it very clear before the invasion that Iraq was an imminent threat.
CIA Director George Tenet has made his first public statements over the debacle of pre-war intelligence on Iraq since David Kaye, the former head of the CIA Weapons Inspection Team, told a Senate committee last week that he was wrong about Iraq having weapons of mass destruction before the invasion. Tenet disagreed with Kaye's assertion that weapons inspectors were about 85% through with their work and that they'll probably not find large stockpiles of the weapons. Tenet said the weapons haven't been found because Iraqis systematically destroyed and looted the evidence. And even if the weapons aren't found, Tenet says that intelligence gathering and interpretation is not a precise science.
By definition, intelligence deals with the unclear, the unknown, the deliberately hidden. What the enemies of the United States hope to deny, we work to reveal. The question being asked about Iraq in the starkest terms is, were we right or were we wrong? In the intelligence business, you are almost never completely wrong or completely right. That applies in full to the question of Saddam's weapons of mass destruction.
Regardless if the intelligence is never fully right or wrong, the administration used the claim that Iraq had weapons of mass destruction to justify the invasion of Iraq. Such ambiguity and misinformation on Iraq is having some lawmakers on Capitol Hill reconsider their support for a preemptive military strike based on intelligence, including California Senator Dianne Feinstein, a Democrat who supported the invasion.
And I cast my vote primarily on the intelligence that I received in daily briefs, as well as reading both the classified and the unclassified versions of the National Intelligence Estimate. And so you can imagine my consternation when we send out literally hundreds of military to the most prominent sites for which we have aerial photographs, satellite photographs, as major suspected sites, and nothing is found.
Feinstein continued to say that the intelligence information that Congress receives comes directly from the Bush administration, which is responsible for the gathering and interpretation of the information. CIA Director Tenet also said on Thursday morning that no one in the intelligence community was pressured by outside forces to manipulate the intelligence. Tenet also said that the intelligence reports did not say that Iraq was an imminent threat.
This estimate asked if Iraq had chemical, biological, and nuclear weapons and the means to deliver them. We concluded that in some of these categories, Iraq had weapons, and that in others where it did not have them, it was trying to develop them. Let me be clear. Analysts differed on several important aspects of these programs, and those debates were spelled out in the estimate. They never said there was an imminent threat. Rather, they painted an objective assessment for our policymakers of a brutal dictator who is continuing his efforts to deceive and build programs that might constantly surprise us and threaten our interests.
Whether or not intelligence reports said Iraq was an imminent threat, top Bush administration officials did, says Judd Legum with the Center for American Progress.
George Tenet's right about that, that intelligence didn't say it was an imminent threat, but who did say it was an imminent threat was the administration. And Scott McClellan recently denied the administration has ever said that, but if you look at the record, you can see they said it a number of times. McClellan himself said that Iraq was an imminent threat to NATO, which the United States is a member of. And when the communications director, Dan Bartlett, was asked by Wolf Blitzer, is Saddam a threat to U.S. interests in either that part of the world or to America right here at home? He said, well, of course it is. So I think it's the case that the administration has been making to the American people. And what George Tenet was saying today is that that case wasn't backed up by the intelligence that he was giving them.
Late Thursday afternoon, lawmakers on the Senate Intelligence Committee, which is investigating the intelligence failure, will complete its final report, though a declassified version is not expected until March. The ranking Democrat on the committee, John Rockefeller, is requesting the committee to expand its review to go beyond looking at just the quality of intelligence. So far, the Republican chair of the committee, Senator Pat Roberts, has denied such a request. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Mitch Jezerich in Washington.
Thousands rallied this afternoon on Wall Street to support striking and locked-out grocery workers in California. The Wall Street protests come a week ahead of Safeway's shareholder meetings. It also comes a day after unions representing 70,000 striking and locked-out workers offered to go back to work if the companies agreed to enter into binding arbitration. But the companies refused. Aaron Glantz and Nok Nguyen have more from Los Angeles.
For more than 4 months, more than 70,000 Southern California grocery workers have been on strike over health care. Unionized supermarket workers used to get health care for free, but Kroger's, Ralph's, Safeway's, Vons and Pavilions, and Albertsons wanted employees to start paying part of their own health care bill. But with their union treasuries depleted, the United Food and Commercial Workers offered to put the future of their health care in the hands of an arbiter. Tom Connors, president of the union's Orange County local.
The strike lockout would end immediately. All strike replacement workers would be terminated. And all striking locked out employees would return to work immediately.
But management turned down that offer, and so the stalemate continues. 9 a.m. in a Burbank Ralph's grocery, and two checkout lanes are open. There are lines of customers in both lanes, but the supermarket is hardly crowded. Meantime, striking workers like Cynthia Hernandez are getting desperate. The 20-year-old single mother used to support her 2-year-old daughter with her $12 an hour salary. Now she's thinking about going on welfare.
We refuse to go on the system, and I'm not going to go on the system, and I need my contract, I need my health care, I need decent wages. We live day by day now, and I'm at the point where I have no money, and it's at the point where I'm going to have to go ask the government for help.
The three supermarket chains did not return calls by airtime, but in published reports, the company's spokespeople have pointed out increased competition from superstores like Walmart, which are non-union, pay close to the minimum wage, and offer no health benefits. Walmart plans to open 40 new superstores with groceries in California over the next 4 years. Los Angeles City Councilman Antonio Villaraigosa is pushing legislation locally in an effort to prevent Walmart from opening its stores.
What the Walmarts of the world are doing in places like Los Angeles is robbing this city of its strength, of its foundation. The foundation of this city is the middle class. They're robbing us of that middle class. When they take a grocery worker who had a health benefit and could buy a decent wage and could buy a home, and now takes away those health benefits, puts them on the public dole, and now they can only rent.
The union estimates the average supermarket worker makes just $20,000 a year. Safeway CEO Steve Bird, by contrast, makes $1 million a year base salary plus bonuses. And since the strike started in October, he's cashed in more than $16 million in stock options. Steve Bird is also a leading fundraiser for George W. Bush, raising more than $100,000 for Bush's reelection campaign. The Reverend Jesse Jackson spoke at the union's press conference.
The fear is that if somehow these three chains lose here, It helps worker organizing across the country. If they win here, they bust unions across the country. This is a profoundly ideological statement. That's why I'm convinced that they are being subsidized. Ordinarily, a company would not take a four-month hit, but they can afford it. They're prepared for the long run. They think they'll make the money back if they can bust workers and take away their benefits.
Jackson notes that in George Bush's 3 years as president, Bush has not met once with organized labor. The president has shown a desire to work with Safeway's Steve Byrd, though. In December, Bush named Byrd to the Department of Homeland Security's Private Sector Advisory Committee. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Aaron Glantz with Nock Nguyen in Los Angeles.
On the heels of yesterday's television address across Pakistan, where nuclear scientist Dr. Abdul Qadir Khan admitted supplying secret information to Iran, Libya, and North Korea, today President Pervez Musharraf pardoned Dr. Khan and added that Pakistan will not allow international supervision of its nuclear program. This comes as seven nuclear scientists in Pakistan are under investigation by government agencies, and some say also by the FBI, for acts of nuclear proliferation. The International Atomic Energy Agency, or the IAEA, last month accused President Musharraf of leaking nuclear secrets to other countries. Pakistan's Foreign Office spokesman in Islamabad reacted by saying that some scientists might be involved in proliferation out of personal greed, which, as our correspondent Masroor Hussain reports, was seen as an attempt to absolve the military of any involvement.
Dr. Abdul Qadir Khan, former government employee and advisor to the Prime Minister, tendered an 11-page signed document to his investigators in which he stated he supplied nuclear secrets to Libya and Iran in order to transfer the technology to other Muslim countries, thus reducing American pressure on Pakistan to roll back its nuclear program. He also admitted helping North Korea build its nuclear bomb. Mohsin Altaf is a student of microbiology at Qaid-e-Azam University in Islamabad.
In my opinion, the government has been involved in all this at one or the other level, and that is the reason these scientists could take such a big step. I think it is humiliation of our nuclear scientists that they are being singled out. I think scientists in no other country have been investigated, and what's happening in Pakistan these days is portraying the country as a belittled and a dangerous place.
According to reports, Pakistan started building a nuclear bomb 30 years ago after Dr. Khan stole information from the Netherlands, where he worked in Pakistan. He headed Pakistan's Atomic Energy Commission, and in 1998, the country conducted nuclear tests and established itself as a nuclear power. Ramzan Ghori runs a TV repair shop.
As far as the issue of nuclear scientists is concerned, we know only what the media tells us, and we form our opinions accordingly. The reality is only known to the government, and it keeps that secret from the people. Sometimes even the courts are not told the truth by the government lawyers. I believe that the people have the right to know what's really happening with the nuclear scientists.
In 1998, when Pakistan conducted nuclear tests, the United States retaliated with economic sanctions. But in the aftermath of 9/11, when it needed support from Pakistan to attack Afghanistan, it not only waived those sanctions but extended another $3 billion in aid to fight the war on terror. The Pakistani government seems to be on defense despite no evidence of American pressure. Shafkatullah is a social activist in Lahore.
That Pakistani state wants to portray itself as the responsible nuclear state. And in this scandal, they want to make it a point that it was never a Pakistani state which gone into the nuclear proliferation. Rather, it is the initiative of certain individuals. They want to take this matter into a procedure in which they can establish that they are going to punish the people.
President Musharraf is expected to address the nation this week on the issue of this scientist. The Religious Opposition Alliance, MMA, or Mutahida Majlis-e-Amal, has summoned the parliament to discuss detention of the scientist. Reaction to recent controversy has been slow due to the second Muslim Eid, but after the holidays, reaction to Dr. Khan's admission will be evident. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Masroor Hussain in Islamabad.
In other South Asian news, today is Kashmir Solidarity Day, a national holiday in Kashmir, and a day when solidarity to occupied Kashmir is extended from many parts of the world. The holiday comes as today at least 4 Indian soldiers were killed and 7 wounded when their vehicle ran over a landmine. Many in Kashmir are using today's holiday to call for peace and independence, subjects which were broached in recent meetings between Kashmiri separatists and the Indian government. The 5-member delegation of the Kashmiri separatist group, the All Parties Hurriyat Conference, met Indian Prime Minister Atal Bihari Vajpayee, with both sides hoping to initiate a process towards resolution of the Kashmir dispute. Both sides agreed to work towards an end to all forms of violence and decided to meet again in March. Shahnawaz Khan reports from Srinagar, the capital of Kashmir.
A 5-member delegation of All Parties Hurriyat Conference met with Indian Deputy Prime Minister L.K. Advani to establish a 2-pronged strategy towards a resolution on Kashmir. The team comprised of moderates in the separatist camp in Kashmir. Professor Ghani Bhatt is the Hurriyat spokesman. The All Parties Hurriyat Conference, an amalgam of separatist groups in Kashmir, split last year, leaving it with a weaker support base. The breakaway faction and the armed groups in Kashmir are opposing the talks. However, Professor Bhatt believes that given time, the opposition and the armed groups will see that dialogue was the best solution.
As soon as they get to know, get to understand the dynamics of the change, they will agree with us that the only way available with us to seek a permanent settlement is the dialogue, a purposeful dialogue involving India, Pakistan and the people of Kashmir.
At the South Asian Association for Regional Cooperation Summit in Islamabad earlier this month, India and Pakistan agreed to bilateral talks on Kashmir. Both India and Pakistan claim rights to Kashmir since independence from Britain and subsequent partition into two nations in 1947. Voices from Kashmir insist on Kashmir being a principal party to the dispute. Analysts in Kashmir believe dialogue between Hurriyat and New Delhi as a step forward. Muhammad Sarwar studies political science at the University of Kashmir.
It is definitely a positive development that of late India is talking to Kashmiri separatist leaders. And it definitely indicates that India of late accepts the disputed nature of Kashmir. And it also indicates that India has realized that there are certain grievances within Kashmiri people that need to be resolved.
While the Hurriyat Conference is optimistic about the dialogue and the initiation of a process, opposing groups doubt the sincerity of India. Syed Ali Gilani heads the breakaway faction of the Hurriyat Conference.
India is playing a game, and to have a supremacy upon the Pakistan, they can tell tomorrow Pakistan, we are talking with our own people in Srinagar. They have some grievances, and we can remove, redress their grievances. You have no right to talk about the Kashmir.
But the moderates say a dialogue is imperative. Mirwais Umar Farooq, one of the 5-member committee that talked to New Delhi, calls this dialogue a breakthrough and believes the dialogue to be the first of the series Hurriyat intends to take. The two will meet again in March.
It will be a phased dialogue. In the first phase, we will talk to New Delhi. And in the second phase, we would definitely talk to Pakistan and to the Mujahideen who have the guns in their hands. So that all the people who are involved in the Kashmir issue, in the Kashmir dispute, are a part of a dialogue. So you can say that the dialogue with Delhi is going to be the first step towards a series of steps which the Hurriyat intends to take in the times to come.
Meanwhile, in Kashmir, there has been no let-up in violence as the skirmishes between the Indian security forces and anti-India militants continue. And the allegations of human rights violations also pour in. Hurriyat Conference says India will have to take measures on this front if the dialogue is to move forward. But more than the intentions of India and Pakistan, Mirwais hopes the US hand behind the scene would help take the dialogue forward. Earlier this month, Colin Powell said the United States helped broker the peace process between India and Pakistan. For Free Speech Radio News, I am Shahnawaz Khan from Srinagar, Kashmir.
A case that could shed some light on the political turmoil on the Pine Ridge Reservation during the 1970s got underway this week in Rapid City, South Dakota. The trial involves Arlo Looking Cloud, who's accused of the 1975 murder of American Indian Movement activist Anna May Pictou Aquash. Pictou Aquash's death and the motives behind it have remained an enduring mystery for nearly 3 decades. And while some people say the trial will bring the truth to light, others say it may only cause deeper divisions between the native community and law enforcement officials and within the American Indian movement itself. FSRN's Charles Michael Ray is in Rapid City, South Dakota.
In February of 1976, a rancher finds the frozen body of a woman in a Badlands gully on the Pine Ridge Reservation. An initial autopsy completed by the FBI and local authorities finds that she died of exposure. Her hands are then cut off and sent to Washington, D.C. for identification, and she's buried as Jane Doe in a small cemetery on Pine Ridge. Weeks later, she's identified as Anime Pictou Akwash, and her family has the body exhumed, and they have an independent autopsy completed, which reveals a gunshot wound to the head. In the following 28 years, a long investigation and several grand juries lead to no arrests in the case, until March of last year, when a homeless man named Arlo Looking Cloud is picked up and indicted for the murder of Anime Pictou Akwash.
This is a sham to blame the least involved, the least culpable of all of the defendants, pin it on him and close the case. So the FBI has not found out that they are covering up their operatives.
Russell Means, an AIM leader during the 1973 occupation of Wounded Knee, alleges that other leaders in the American Indian Movement, including Vernon Belcourt, ordered Pictou Akwash's execution. Means alleges that the FBI was also involved, but he doesn't think that the real story will come out in this trial. Meanwhile, AIM leader Vernon Belcourt denies all allegations that AIM had anything to do with Pictou Akwash's death. Belcourt alleges that she was murdered by the FBI in an attempt to disrupt the movement. He says the government's part in this case will be made clear in this trial.
Fact is, bottom line, there have been dozens of deaths on the Pine Ridge Reservation of both men and women, in addition to Anime Akwash. And we would hope that at some point, there's got to be a major investigation into the deaths of all the people and what role the U.S. government, and specifically the FBI, played in that whole climate of terror that was created by the FBI.
Federal officials have strongly denied any involvement in the murder, but both the FBI and the U.S. Attorney for South Dakota, Jim McMahon, say they cannot comment further on this case because they don't want to interfere with the trial. While there may be disagreement among some members of AIM over this issue, one of the relatives of the victim, Robert Pictou Branscombe, says he believes the truth will come out in this trial.
There's almost like been a blanket of fear, you know, over South Dakota, and today people are talking. And I think it'll in the long run, it will help a lot of our reservations and a lot of families.
Branscombe says he believes AIM leaders were involved in the murder of Pictou Akwash because they suspected she was an FBI informant. He says he wants justice from this case.
I believe that Anime is the door to opening in regards to these other cases of people that were killed on Pine Ridge and Rosebud reservations. You know, but there was a lot of deaths during that time that have never been solved, and let's get to the bottom of it and find out exactly what took place up there.
The two men indicted and accused of the murder are former AIM members. Arlo Looking Cloud was living on the streets of Denver at the time of his arrest, and John Graham, a Canadian resident, is out on bond and is reportedly fighting extradition to the U.S. The trial is underway in Rapid City, and the jury selection has been completed. But Vernon Belcourt doubts whether an impartial jury can be picked anywhere in South Dakota.
Study after study, including the U.S. Commission on Civil Rights, has ascertained on several occasions that it's virtually impossible for a Native American person to get a fair trial in the state of South Dakota.
The prosecution will be calling more witnesses in this trial today, and attorneys for the government say that they are almost ready to rest their case. So far, one witness has testified to a belief that AIM was involved in the murder of Akwash, but AIM leaders say prosecutors have so far failed to make their case. Officials say the trial could be wrapped up by tomorrow. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Charles Michael Ray in Rapid City.
You've been listening to Free Speech Radio News. You can go to our website for an archive of the newscast, www.fsrn.org. I'm Deepa Fernandez.